desires, while she is still trapped in a hunger that rushes past everything. She spades her arms under his wasted body and draws him toward one side of the mechanical bed. Then she walks around to the other side and gets in next to him.
Tell me.
But of course he can't. He makes that chuckle in the back of his throat that could mean anything. She reaches for his hand and they hold still, as if they are already the carved figures on top of their own tomb. They lie for a long time, staring out across their property where hunter-gatherers made their way for millennia. She sees plenty, all the various trees of their would-be arboretum, their buds at the ready, but she knows she isn't catching a tenth of what he is.
Tell me more about her.
Her heart pumps harder at the taboo question. All her life she has flirted with craziness, and still this new winter game of theirs feels worse than scary. Strangers are out tonight, wandering, knocking on their door, and she lets them in. His arm tightens, and his face does change.
Moves fast. Will fed.
It's like he's just written remembrance of things past.
What does she look like?
She has asked before, but needs the answer again.
Fierce. Fine. You.
It's enough to get her back into the book, and the yard opens like two pages spread in front of her. Tonight, in the growing darkness, the story runs in reverse. A succession of girls, younger and younger, head out the back door and into the miniature simulated world. Their daughter, at 20, on spring break from college, in a sleeveless tank top that reveals a horrible new Baroque tattoo on her left shoulder, sneaking out to smoke a joint after her parents have fallen asleep. Their daughter, at 16, swilling cheap grocery store wine with two girlfriends in the farthest dark corner of the property. Their daughter, at 12, in a funk, kicking a soccer ball against the garage for hours. Their daughter at 10, floating across the grass, catching lightning bugs in a jar. Their daughter at 6, heading out barefoot on the first 70-degree spring day with a seedling in her hands. The image appears against the shadowy trees. It's so vivid that Dorothy is sure she's seen some model for it somewhere. This is how read-aloud goes now, the two of them holding still and watching. Who knows what the lifelong stranger in her house is ever thinking? She does, now. Something like this. Something exactly like this. The paper cup has sat on the kitchen windowsill of her imagination for so long now that Dorothy can see the brown and cyan curlicues of stylized steam printed on it, and read the word beneath the design, Solo. A mass of eager roots has punched through the waxy paper bottom, in need of more world. Marvelous, long, serrated leaves, American chestnut, paw at the air on their first trip outside. Dorothy watches the girl and her father kneel at the edge of a freshly dug hole. The fretful child chops at the dirt with a trowel. She administers the sacrament of first water. She steps away from the planting, back underneath the arm of her father. And when the girl turns around and lifts her face, in this other life unfolding invisibly alongside the one that happened, Dorothy sees the face of her daughter, ready to take on all of life. Two words up close to her ear explode the silence. Do nothing. The words are as clear as they need to be, telling Dorothy that her husband has been out there with her in that other place, or not far away. Much the same thought has just occurred to her. They got the thought independently, from the same startling sentence in the same startling book that they just read together. The best and easiest way to get a forest to return to any plot of cleared land is to do nothing, nothing at all, and do it for less time than you might think.
"No more mowing,"
Ray whispers, and she doesn't even have to ask for explanation. What better inheritance could they leave such a willful, fierce, and fine daughter than an acre and a half of woods? Side by side, in his mechanical bed, they lie and gaze out the window, where great snows pile up and melt away. The rains come, transient birds return, days grow long again, buds on every branch put forth flowers, and hundreds of seedlings push up wildly through the recidivist lawn.
"You can't do this. You have a child."
Adam sits back on the love seat, toying with the black box on his ankle. Lois, his wife, sits across from him, palms on thighs, spine like a telephone pole. He sways, limp in the stale air. He can no longer explain himself. He has no answer. For 2 days, the two of them have followed that fact down to hell. He stares out the window as the lights of the financial district replace the day. 10 million points flicker in the falling dark, like the logic gates of a circuit cranking out solutions to a calculation generations in the making. A 5-year-old. He needs a father. The child has been in Connecticut for only a day and a half, and already Adam can't remember which of the boy's earlobes has the nick in it, or how the boy came to be 5 years old when he was just born, or how he, Adam, could be the father of anyone. He'll grow up resenting you. You'll be some stranger in federal prison that he goes to visit until I stop making him. She doesn't throw it in his face, although she should. He is, in fact, some stranger already. She just never knew. And the boy, alien already to Adam. For 2 weeks last year, Charlie wanted to be a firefighter, but soon realized that banker beat that in every measurable way. He likes nothing more than to line his toys up with a ruler, count them, and put them away in lockable containers. The only thing he has ever used nail polish for is to mark his little cars so neither parent can steal them. Adam's head swings back into the room, to the figure on the barstool across from him. His wife's lips sour and her cheeks flush, like she's choking. Since his arrest, she has begun to seem as vague to him as his own life did on the day he slipped back into Santa Cruz and began to simulate it.
"You want me to make a deal?"
"Adam," her voice is a controlled skid, "you will never come out again."
"You think I should condemn someone else? I'm just asking."
"It's justice. They're felons. And one of them condemned you."
He turns back to the window. House arrest. Below, the shimmer of NoHo, the flare of Little Italy, the country he's now barred from. And farther away, beyond all neighborhoods, the Atlantic's black cliff. The skyline is an experimental score for some euphoric music he can almost hear. Off to the right, out of sight, the twisted tower rises, replacing the gutted ones. Freedom.
"If it's justice we're after."
A voice that should be familiar to him says,
"What's wrong with you? You're going to put another person's welfare before your own son?"
There it is. The ultimate commandment. Take care of your own. Protect your genes. Lay down your life for one child, two siblings,
or 8 first cousins. How many friends would that translate to? How many strangers who might still be out there laying down their lives for other species? How many trees? He can't begin to tell his wife the worst of it. Since his arrest, since beginning to think objectively again after so many years of treating the question as an abstraction, he has begun to see that the dead woman was right. The world is full of welfares that must come even before your own kind. If I cut a deal, then my son, then Charlie grows up knowing what I did. He'll know you made a hard choice, that you righted a wrong. The laugh pops out of Adam. Righted a wrong? Lois bolts up. Fury chokes her words before she can spit them. As the door slams shut behind her, he remembers his wife and what she's capable of. He falls into a half-sleep, imagining what the law will do to him. He turns, and fire shoots through his lower spine. The pain wakes him. A huge moon hangs low over the Hudson. Every steel-white pockmark in its face shines telescope clear. The prospect of life in prison does wonders for his eyesight. His bladder hurts. He stands and starts a reflex overland expedition across the apartment to the bathroom, when a wrong cloud falls over his view. He crosses to the window and puts his hand to it. Condensation rims his palm like cave art. Down in the canyon below, streaks of car lights clump and disperse. There, between the spotty traffic, a pack of gray wolves comes down Waverly from Washington Square, chasing a white-tailed deer. He jerks forward, smacking his forehead against the plate glass. Obscenity shoots out of him, his first in years. He stumbles through the kitchen into the cramped living room, clipping his shoulder on the doorframe. The bump spins him, and stabbing with his right hand to break his fall, he bounces face first into the windowsill. The impact clamps his mouth shut on his lower lip and drops him to the floor. There he lies, stupid with agony. His fingers test his mouth and come away sticky. His right incisor has bitten through his lower lip from both sides. He rises to his knees and looks out above the sill. The moon shines over the tip of a tree-covered island. Brick, steel, and right angles give way to moonlit, mounded green. A stream runs through a ravine that cuts toward West Houston. The towers of the financial district are gone, changed into wooded hills. Above, the spill of the Milky Way, a torrent of stars. It's the mind-crushing pain of his cut lip, the stress of his arrest. He thinks, I'm not actually seeing this. I'm lying senseless from the blow on the living room floor. And yet it spreads outward below him, in all directions, a forest as dense, terrifying, and inescapable as childhood. Arboretum America. His sight grows huge, magnifying the many colors and habits of the whole. Hornbeam, oak, cherry, half a dozen kinds of maple. Honey locusts armored with thorns against extinct megafauna. Pignut hickories dropping meals for anything that moves. Waxy, flat, white dogwood blooms float in the understory on invisibly thin twigs. Wilderness rushes down Lower Broadway, the island as it was 1,000 years back, or 1,000 years on. A flash hooks his eye. Off toward a ridge of oak, a great horned owl sweeps its wings above its head and drops like a shot onto something moving in the leaf litter below. A black bear sow and two cubs track across a hillock where Bleecker Street was. Sea turtles lay their eggs by the full moon on the sandy banks of the East River. Adam's breath fogs the glass, and the view grays over. Blood trickles down his chin. He touches his mouth and comes away with grit, stony between his fingertips. He glances down to inspect the bits of chipped tooth. When he looks up again, Manahatta is gone, replaced by the lights of Lower Manhattan. He smacks the window with his palm. The metropolis on the other side fails to hiccup. His pulse pounds in his forearms, and he starts to shake. The buildings, like crossword puzzles, the red and white corpuscles of traffic, more hallucinatory than what just vanished. He picks his way through the minefield of furniture and scattered journals to the foyer and out the door. 6 steps down the hall, he remembers his anklet. He slumps against one wall with his eyes squeezed shut. When the vision dies at last, he turns back into the apartment and seals himself up in the only habitat allowed him, his lone biome, for a long time to come. Mimi Ma sits in the auditorium's second row, transfixed by something the tree woman just said. Patricia Westerford. The 5 of them shared her discoveries over campfires back when the free bioregion of Cascadia was still a place. Her words made them real, those alien agents doing things beyond the narrow consciousness of humans. The woman is older than Mimi imagined, frightened and faltering, and there's something wrong with her speech. But she has just delivered this fine, sane, but somehow taboo rule. What you make from a tree should be at least as miraculous as what you cut down. What the forest makes of the mountain is better than the mountain. What people might make of the forest. The thought barely germinates when Dr. Westerford jolts Mimi back.
I've asked myself the question you brought me here to answer.
Mimi's first thought is that she's mistaken, a distinguished researcher and author, someone who has spent decades saving seeds from the world's endangered trees. It can't be happening. She must be wrong.
I've thought about it based on all the evidence available. I've tried not to let my feelings protect me from the facts.
The whole soliloquy is a piece of theater, heading toward some last-minute reverse or reveal.
I've tried not to let hope and vanity blind me. I've tried to see this matter from the standpoint of trees.
Mimi looks down her aisle. People sit in disbelief, pinned in their seats with the full weight of shame.
What is the single best thing a person can do for tomorrow's world?
Another woman once asked Mimi this, and the answer, so obvious, so reason-driven, burn down a luxury ski resort before it could be built. The plant extracts hit the glass. Green spreads through the water, snaking like a time-lapse bud sped up 100,000-fold. Mimi, 40 feet from the podium, can't move. Dr. Westerford lifts the glass like a priest raising a sacrament. Her speech thickens to a paste.
Many living things choose their own season. Maybe most of them.
It's happening. It's real. But hundreds of the world's smartest people hold still.
You asked me here to talk about home repair. We're the ones who need repairing. Trees remember what we've forgotten. Every speculation must make room for another. Dying is life, too.
Dr. Westerford glances down, and Mimi is waiting for her. She locks on to the tree woman's gaze and won't let go. Long ago, in another life, she was an engineer and could make matter do so many things. Now she knows only this one skill, how to look at another being until it looks back. Mimi pleads, her eyes burning.
No, don't, please.
The speaker frowns. Everything else is hypocrisy. You're needed.
Needed for this. We are too many.
That's not for you to decide.
A new city the size of Des Moines every day.
What about your work, your seed vault?
It has run itself for years.
There's so much more to do.
I'm an old woman. What better work than this is left?
People won't understand. They'll hate you. It's too theatrical.
It will get a moment of attention amid all the screaming.
It's immature, not worthy of you.
We need to remember how to die.
You'll die horribly.
No, I know my plants. This one will be easier than most.
I can't watch this again.
Watch again. It's all there is.
The glance lasts no longer than it takes a leaf to eat a chunk of light. Mimi fights to hold the speaker's gaze, but with a last act of will, the tree woman breaks away. Patricia Westerford lifts her gaze back onto the cavernous room. Her smile insists that this isn't defeat. It's use by another name. A small thing, a way to buy a little more time, a few more resources. She glances back down at a horrified Mimi.
The things we might see, the things we could still give.
There's a beach in Ohio Patricia would like to see again. Of all the trees she'll miss like breathing, a simple, smooth-boled beech with nothing special to it except a notch on its trunk 4 feet up from the ground. Maybe it has thrived. Maybe the sun and rain and air have been good to it. She thinks,
maybe we want to hurt trees so much because they live so much longer than we do.
Plant Patty raises her glass. She scans her speech for the last line on the last page.
To Tachygalli versicolor.
She looks up. 300 brilliant people watch her, awed. The soundtrack is silent, except for muffled shouting by the lip of the stage. She glances over at the commotion. A man in a wheelchair rolls up to the right-hand stair. His hair and beard flow down around his shoulders. He's as thin as the talking tree person of the Yaqui, the one no one could understand. Alone of all the people in this paralyzed room, he pushes down against his chair, trying to stand. The green liquid splatters over the glass's lip into her hand. She looks again. The man in the chair waves wildly. His twig arms fling outward. How can something so small matter so much to him? The single best thing you can do for the world. It occurs to her, the problem begins with that word, world. It means two such opposite things. The real one we cannot see. The invented one we can't escape. She lifts the glass and hears her father read out loud,
"Let me sing to you now about how people turn into other things."
Nile's shouts come too late to break the room's spell. The speaker raises her glass, and the world splits. Down one branch, she lifts the glass to her lips, toasts the room,
to Tachygalli versicolor, and drinks.
Down another branch, this one, she shouts,
"Here's to unsuicide!"
and flings the cup of swirling green over the gasping audience. She bumps the podium, backs away, and stumbles into the wings, leaving the room to stare at an empty stage. In the spring, the lush, too warm spring, when the buds and flowers go mad on every dogwood and redbud and pear and weeping cherry in the city, Adam's case at last runs out of delays and heads to a federal court on the West Coast. Reporters fill the courtroom like ants swarming a peony. The bailiff leads Adam in. He's stocky now, bearded. Furrows contour plow his face. He wears the suit he last wore to the awards banquet where he accepted his university's top teaching prize. His wife is there, seated in the row behind him, but not his boy. His boy will only ever see his father like this many years later, on video. How do you plead? The psych professor blinks, as if he's another form of life altogether, and human speech is way too fast to understand. Over the empty sill, through the kitchen window, Dorothy Brinkman looks out onto a jungle. The man who never once failed to feed a parking meter has launched her on a made-to-order revolution. The Brinkman Woodlands Restoration Project. Wildness advances on all sides of the house. The grass is foot-high, clumped, weedy, seeding, and thick with native volunteers. Maples pop up everywhere, like paired hands. Ankle-high hackberries flaunt their paisley leaves. The speed of the reclamation stuns her. A few more years, and their stand of woods will half reprise whatever came before the invading subdivision. Her own second growth is even faster. Once, long ago, she jumped from airplanes, played a bloody-minded murderess, did terrible things to anyone who tried to confine her. Now, she's almost 70, at war with the entire city. Jungle in an upscale suburb. It's up there with child molesting. The neighbors have come by on 3 separate occasions to ask if there's anything wrong. They volunteer to mow for free. She plays herself, sweet, demented, just adamant enough to hold them at bay, a last amateur theatrical comeback tour. Now the whole street is ready to stone her. The city has written twice, the second time a registered letter giving her a deadline to clean up the place or face a fine of several $100. The deadline has come and gone. And with it, another threatening letter, another deadline, and another assessed fine. Who would have thought the foundations of society would be so shaken by a little runaway green? The new deadline is today. She looks out on the chestnut, the tree that shouldn't be there. Last week she heard a radio story about how 30 years of crossbreeding has at last produced a blight-resistant American chestnut tree about to be tested in the wild. The tree that seemed to her like a spared memory now looks like a prediction. A flash of orange at the window catches her eye. American redstart, male, flushing insects from the thicket with its tail and wings. 22 species of birds this last week alone. 2 days ago, at twilight, she and Ray saw a fox. Civil disobedience may cost them thousands in compounding penalties, but the view from the house has been much improved. She's making fruit compote for Ray's lunch when the awaited angry knock comes on the front door. She flushes with excitement. More than excitement, purpose. A touch of fear, but the most delicious kind. She rinses and dries her hands, thinking, here I am, near the finish line, loving life again. The knock gets faster and louder. She crosses through the living room, reviewing in her head the defense of their property rights that Ray has helped her prepare. She has spent days at the public library, and the municipal building, learning how to read local ordinances, legal precedent, and municipal code. She has brought back copies to her husband for explanation, one stunted syllable at a time. She has pored through books, compiling stats on just how criminal mowing, watering, and fertilizing are, just how much good a reforested acre and a half can do. All the arguments of sanity and sense are on her side. Against her, there is only one unreasoning and primal desire. But when she opens the door, it's on a scrawny kid in jeans and polo shirt, stringy blonde hair sticking out from under his made-in-the-USA ball cap, and the whole plan of defense changes. "Mrs. Brinkman?" Behind the kid, out by the curb, three even younger boys, shouting back and forth in Spanish, unload lawn equipment from a pickup truck and flatbed trailer. "We're here from the city to clean up your place. We'll only take a few hours, and the city won't bill you until later." "No," she says, and the rich, warm, wise sound of that single syllable confuses the boy. He opens his mouth, but he's way too baffled to make it say anything. She smiles and heaves her chest. "You really don't want to do that? Tell the city that would be a terrible mistake." She remembers the secret from her days on stage. Mobilize your inner will. Summon all the memory of a life lived. Hold it in your head. Right and wrong. The truth, self-evident. Nothing has more power than simple conviction. The boy wavers. The city failed to prepare him for such authority. "Well, if it's all right," she smiles and shakes her head, embarrassed for him. "It isn't all right. It really isn't." "You know better. Please don't make me shame you even worse." The boy panics. She looks at him with affection, understanding, most of all, pity, until he turns away and calls the crew and the gear back into the truck. Dorothy shuts the door and cackles as they drive away. She always did enjoy playing a good madwoman. It's the smallest of victories, the slightest postponement. The city will be back. The mowers and clippers will set to work, next time swarming without asking. They'll shave the yard clean. The fines will pile up with the late fees and penalties. Dorothy will countersue, fighting in court until the last appeal. Let the city confiscate the house and throw a paralyzed man in jail. She will outlast them. The anarchy of new seedlings and next spring is on her side. She heads back to the kitchen, where she finishes making lunch. She feeds Ray, telling him about the poor boy and his foreign work crew who never knew what hit them. She acts out all the parts. The most fun is playing herself. She can see him smile, although no one else in the world would be able to confirm. After lunch, they work the crossword. Then, as he often does these days, Ray says,
"Tell more."
Dorothy smiles and climbs into bed next to him. She looks out back, through the window, on the riot of new growth. In its middle, the tree that shouldn't be there. Its branches rush outward, toward the house, slowly to be sure, but fast enough to inspire her. How life managed to add imagination to all the other tricks in its chemistry set is a mystery Dorothy can't wrap her head around. But there it is. The ability to see all at once, in all its concurrent branches, all its many hypotheticals, this thing that bridges past and future, earth and sky. She's a good girl, you know. She takes her husband's stiff claw. She was just lost for a little while. All she needs to do is find herself, find a cause, something bigger than she is. The prosecution shows photos from the scene of one of the man's alleged crimes. A bit of graffiti on a charred wall. The first letters of each line sprout tendrils and vines, like the capitals of an illuminated manuscript. Control kills. Connection heals. Come home or die. It's the centerpiece of their case, the grounds for the extraordinary sentence they're demanding. They mean to prove intimidation, an attempt to influence the conduct of government by force. Adam's lawyers argue for mercy. They claim the fires were set by a young idealist calling the public's attention to a crime against everyone. They say the sales of the forest were themselves illegal, and the government failed to protect lands entrusted to it. Countless peaceful protests had come to nothing. But they have no case. The law is clear on every count. He's guilty of arson, guilty of destruction of private property, guilty of violence against the public well-being, guilty of manslaughter. Guilty, the jury of Adam Apich's peers concludes, of domestic terrorism. The law is simply human will written down. The law must let every acre of living earth be turned into tarmac, if such is the desire of people. But the law lets all parties have their say. The judge asks, "Would you care to address any final words to the court?" Thoughts ring Adam's head. The verdicts have cut him loose, like windthrow or fire. "Soon we'll know if we were right or wrong." The court sentences Adam Apich to 2 consecutive terms of 70 years each. The lenience shocks him. He thinks, 70 plus 70 is nothing. A black willow plus a wild cherry. He was thinking oak. He was thinking Douglas fir or yew. 70 plus 70. With reductions for good behavior, he might even finish out the first half of the sentence just in time to die. Seeds. From the Rig Veda, 1031-7. What was the wood, what the tree out of which heaven and earth were fashioned? From Julian of Norwich. And in this he showed me a little thing, the quantity of a hazelnut, lying in the palm of my hand, as it seemed, and it was as round as any ball. I looked upon it with the eye of my understanding, and thought, "What may this be?" And it was answered generally thus, "It is all that is made." Say the planet is born at midnight, and it runs for one day. First there is nothing. 2 hours are lost to lava and meteors. Life doesn't show up until 3 or 4 a.m. Even then, it's just the barest self-copying bits and pieces. From dawn to late morning, 1 million years of branching, nothing more exists than lean and simple cells. Then there is everything. Something wild happens not long after noon. One kind of simple cell enslaves a couple of others. Nuclei get membranes. Cells evolve organelles. What was once a solo campsite grows into a town. The day is 2/3 done when animals and plants part ways. And still, life is only single cells. Dusk falls before compound life takes hold. Every large living thing is a latecomer, showing up after dark. 9 p.m.,
brings jellyfish and worms. Later that hour comes the breakout. Backbones, cartilage, an explosion of body forms. From one instant to the next, countless new stems and twigs in the spreading crown burst open and run. Plants make it up on land just before 10. Then insects, who instantly take to the air. Moments later, tetrapods crawl up from the tidal muck, carrying around on their skin and in their guts whole worlds of earlier creatures. By 11, dinosaurs have shot their bolt, leaving the mammals and birds in charge for an hour. Somewhere in that last 60 minutes, high up in the phylogenetic canopy, life grows aware. Creatures start to speculate. Animals start teaching their children about the past and the future. Animals learn to hold rituals. Anatomically modern man shows up 4 seconds before midnight. The first cave paintings appear 3 seconds later. And in a thousandth of a click of the second hand, life solves the mystery of DNA and starts to map the tree of life itself. By midnight, most of the globe is converted to row crops for the care and feeding of one species. And that's when the tree of life becomes something else again. That's when the giant trunk starts to teeter. Nick wakes in the tent with his head against the ground. But the earth is soft, as soft as any pillow. The soil beneath is several feet deep with needles. So many dropping, dying needles turning to microscopic life again under his ear. The birds wake him. They always do. The daily prophets of forgetting and remembering, deep into their songs even before the light starts to break. He's grateful to them. They give him each day an early start. He lies still in the dark, hungry, listening to the birds discuss life in 1,000 ancient dialects. Bickering, turf war, recollection, praise, joy. It's cold this morning, fogged in with gloom, and he doesn't want to get out of the bag. Breakfast will be meager. There's not much food left. He has been north for days, and he'll have to find a town and resupply before long. There's a road within earshot, with trucks shuffling, but the sound is abstract, muffled, far away. He crawls from the nylon egg and looks. The first faint suggestion of dawn outlines the trees. The trees are smaller here, slender to the skirts, shaped for heavy snowfalls. But it happens to him again, as it always does now. The look of the waving trunks, the cones rustling, the way the branch tips feel each other out, the astringent citrus scent of the needles all restore him to the crystalline reason he forever keeps forgetting. Up in the morning, his crazy singing adds to the dawn chorus. Out on the job! The nearest birds fall silent and listen. Work like the devil for my pay! A small fire suffices to boil the water, drawn from a generous stream. Pinch of coffee crystals, a fist of oats in a wooden cup, and he's ready. Mimi in Mission Dolores Park, San Francisco, many miles south. She sits in the grass surrounded by picnickers under a knobcone pine, tapping at her phone. The news is a nightmare she can't wake from. An accomplished social scientist with a wife and young son, a man she once trusted with her life, is going away for 2 lifetimes, for something she helped do. Convicted of domestic terrorism. Little or no attempt at defense.
found guilty of fires she can't believe he set. Eco-radical, sentenced to 140 years. And another man, a man she loved for his earnest cartoon innocence, has sold him out. Cross-legged on the ground, her back against the bark, she feeds keywords into her phone. Adam Apich, Terrorist Penalties Enhancement Act. She no longer cares what breadcrumb trails she's leaving. Getting caught would solve so many things. Pages swell and link faster than she can skim them. Expert analysis and angry amateur conjecture. She should be in prison. She should be tried and sentenced to life. Two lives. Guilt comes up her throat, and she tastes it. Her sick legs want to stand and take her into the nearest police station, but she doesn't even know where that might be. That's how law-abiding she has been for two decades. Nearby sunbathers turn to look at her. She has said something out loud. She thinks it might have been, "Help me." Other eyes, invisible, read alongside hers. In the time it takes Mimi to scan 10 paragraphs, the bodiless eyes read 10 million. She retains no more than half a dozen details that fade as soon as she flips to a new page, but the invisible learners preserve every single word and fit them into branching networks of sense that grow stronger with each addition. The more she reads, the more the facts evade her. The more the learners read, the more patterns they find. Douglas sits at a student desk in the room his captors call a cell. It's the nicest accommodation he's had for 2 decades. He's listening to an audio course, Introduction to Dendrology. He can get college credit for it. Maybe he'll earn a degree. Maybe that would make her proud, the woman he knows he hasn't a chance in hell of ever seeing again. The professor on the tapes is great. She's like the grandmother and mother and spiritual guidance counselor Douglas never had. He loves how they're using people with speech impediments these days for audio lectures. This woman is hearing other voices altogether. He listens and takes notes. At the top of the page, he writes, "The Day of Life." It's crazy what the woman on the tape is saying. He had no idea. Life. Flatlined for 1 billion years or more. Unbelievable. The whole escapade might never have happened. The Tree of Life might have stayed a shrub forever. And the Day of Life might have been a very quiet day. He listens as she clicks off the hours, and when the brutes show up in the last seconds to turn the whole planet into a factory farm, he yanks out the buds, gets up, and lets loose. Maybe a little too long and loud. The duty guard looks in on him. "The hell's going on in here?"
"Nothing, man. All good. Just a little screaming is all."
The worst part is the photo. Mimi wouldn't recognize the man if she passed him on the street. Maple. How could they ever have called him that? Bristlecone, now. The narrowest strips of living bark on a withered piece of driftwood that has been dying for 5,000 years. She looks up. People sprawl near her in small clans. Some sit on blankets. Others lie down right in the patchy grass. Shoes, shirts, bags, bicycles, and food spread around them. Lunch is on. The sky cooperates. No judgments can touch them, and all futures remain reachable. She has performed Judith Hansen for so many years that it shocks her now to remember the crimes she committed as Mimi Ma, and the punishments that wait for her in that name. To get to this park, she has walked, hopped a bus, and taken the train. Ludicrous serpentine evasion. But they'll find her, wherever she is, whatever trail she leaves. She's a multiple felon, a manslaughterer, domestic terrorist, 70 plus 70 years. Signals swarm through Mimi's phone. Suppressed updates and smart alerts chime at her. Notifications to flick away. Viral memes and clickable comment wars, millions of unread posts demanding to be ranked. Everyone around her in the park is likewise busy, tapping and swiping, each with a universe in his palm. A massive, crowd-sourced urgency unfolds in Likeland, and the learners, watching over these humans' shoulders, noting each time a person clicks, begin to see what it might be. People vanishing en masse into a replicated paradise. Near Mimi in the grass, a boy in chitin-looking clothing says into his hand, "Where's the nearest place I can buy some sunscreen?" A pleasant woman answers, "Here's what I found for you." Mimi holds her phone close to her face. She bounces from news to pictures, analysis to video. Somewhere in this tiny black monolith is a bit of her father. Pieces of his brain and soul. She whispers into her own phone's mic, "Where's the nearest police station?" A map appears, showing the fastest route and how many minutes it would take her to walk. 5.3. The boy in the bug skeleton apparel tells his phone, "Play me some cowpunk," and disappears into his wireless buds. Adam lies in his bunk in a transfer facility while the overflowing federal system searches for space to house him. There will be no appeal. He's watching a film on the phosphenes inside his closed eyelids of a bearded man confronting the court. The lack of remorse or bargaining. The wife, 2 rows behind him, going to pieces. Soon we'll know if we were right or wrong. He wonders how he found it in him to use the word "we." But he's glad he did. Everything was "we" back then. A surrender to cooperative existence. We, the 5 of us. No separate trees in a forest. What had they hoped to win? Wilderness is gone. Forest has succumbed to chemically sustained silviculture. 4 billion years of evolution, and that's where the matter will end. Politically, practically, emotionally, intellectually. Humans are all that count, the final word. You cannot shut down human hunger. You cannot even slow it. Just holding steady costs more than the race can afford. The coming massacre was their authority. A cataclysm large enough to pardon every fire the 5 of them lit. That cataclysm will still come, he's sure of it, long before his 70 plus 70 years are up, but not soon enough to exonerate him. The window in Dougie's cell is too high up to see through. He stands underneath, pretending. The audio course has made him crazy to see a tree, any anemic, stunted thing, the one thing from free-range life, aside from Mimi, he misses most, despite the shit they got him in. But the weird thing is, he can't remember how they go, how a noble fir looks in profile, how the parts of an ironwood connect, the way the branches run. He's even getting shaky about Engelmans and hemlocks. Trees he saw so damn many of for so damn long. An elm, a tupelo, a buckeye? Forget it. If he drew one now, it would be like some 5-year-old's crude crayon sketch. Cotton candy on a stick. He didn't look hard enough. He loved too little. More than enough to jail him, too little to get him through today. But he has hour after empty hour with no great obligation but to keep from going apeshit crazy. His eyes close and he thrashes around for calm. He tries to summon the details that the audio tape reels off. The straight bronze spears of beech buds, the buds of a red oak, massed on the branch tips like maces, the hollow end of a sycamore's leaf stem, cupped over next year's start, the taste of a black walnut, and the look of its monkey-faced leaf scars. After a while, they start to solidify, simple at first, but gaining grain, the way a maple in spring flushes red from the top, the polite applause of aspens, a yew reaching out, like a parent taking a child's hand, whiffs of scratched hickory nut. Dams break and memories flood him, like the million keyholes of light coming down through the palms of a horse chestnut. The angle between locust thorns, the turbulence in a piece of turned olive wood, sprays of a mimosa's foliage, like the tails of tropical birds. The secret writing on peeled-back birch bark, its words blurred and cryptic. Walking under Lombardy poplars, where the calm was so heavy that even inhaling seemed a crime. Scraping against a cypress and thinking, this is what the afterlife should smell like. He may be the richest man who ever lived. So rich he can lose it all and still turn a profit. He stands next to the green cinder block wall, its paint like shiny, hardened flesh. He looks up into the fall of light and tries to recall. His hand presses where it always does, against the walnut in the side of his belly, just above his belt. Something is in there, a sizable seed, impossible to picture. Not an ally, but life just the same. Another rich man, the 63rd richest in Santa Clara County, sits in his own confinement, typing into a screen. Does it matter where? The words Neeley writes add to a growing organism, one that has just now begun to add to itself. At other screens in other cities, all the best coders that several $100 million can hire contribute to the work in progress. Their brand new venture into cooperation is off to the most remarkable beginning. Already their creatures swallow up whole continents of data, finding in them the most surprising patterns. Nothing needs to start from scratch. There's so much digital germplasm already in the public domain. The coders tell the listeners nothing except how to look. Then the new creations head off to scout the globe, and the code spreads outward. New theories, new offspring, and more evolving species, all of them sharing a single goal, to find out how big life is, how connected, and what it would take for people to unsuicide. The Earth has become again the deepest, finest game, and the learners just its latest players. Wild in their diversity, they fly up, flock into the data sphere like origami birds. Some will thrive for a while, then fall away. The ones that hit on something right will increase and multiply. As Neeley has learned with the greatest pain, life has a way of talking to the future. It's called memory. Other learners, born yesterday, study every button Judith Hansen clicks. They follow her to the gargantuan film archive, where 13 more years of new video have sprouted so far today. Learners have already watched billions of these clips and begin to make their inferences. They can identify faces now, and landmarks, books, paintings, buildings, and commercial products. Soon enough, they'll start guessing at what the films mean. Life is speculation, and these new speculations strain to come alive. Mimi clicks. Videos line up beneath the headline clips, gathered by invisible agents smart enough to know that if Judith Hansen watched that, she will surely want to watch these. Life Defense Force, Forest Wars, Redwood Summer. Mimi binges. Each 6-minute clip takes forever, and she rarely lasts more than a few dozen seconds. She clicks on a clip called Arboreal. It was posted months ago and has already acquired thousands.